On Draft podcast is recorded live in Detroit Sound Studios in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Now, pop that 40 and kick back with your hosts, Dan, Nick, Ken, Rob, and Matt.
That try to pass
episode 78.5 of the Better on Draft podcast. We've had a blast with Brewery Becker on that we decided to continue the conversation here, as well as Brewgiver. Don't worry, we know you're still here as much as you're doing everything else. But I think you're just here for the beer. I think that's the truth.
Exactly. The Brewgiver is actually everywhere in Michigan beer. You can't go to a brewery in Michigan or drink beer in Michigan without feeling this.
Well, you talked about ABC in India. What other beers, brewers, breweries that you've helped out? I mean, you mentioned 60, which is a huge number, especially because obviously you can't keep up with the explosion in the last 3 years and do everything. So where else have you founders? Bells?
No. Shorts? Not a Founders and Bells. I mean, I've known Larry Bell from the very beginning. And when I come into the room, Larry knows me and I know him. And he does indeed pause and says hello. And I appreciate that. I've never actually done work for Larry, but I have been at it as long as Larry's been at it. And he appreciates it and I appreciate it. I helped a lot of different breweries over the years. There were, a lot of home brewers. I mean, Dragon Mead. You saw the paddle at Dragon Mead, the Broken Paddle IPA that they make.
Okay,
I made the paddle.
Oh,
and they carved notches in it to make gallons, and it broke at one of the notches. That's not my fault.
You're still defensive about that, huh? After all these years.
No. Well, again, I think it's really cool that the paddle that I built for Dragon Mead for their very first, homebrew system built out of kegels is the paddle that I built for those guys. And I actually probably carved the notches because they were asking about, how full is the tank or whatever.
When you say paddle, do you mean like a boat oar?
If you go to Dragon Mead.
Love Mount Grossbeck, by the way.
If you go to Dragon Mead, they have a Broken Paddle IPA. And if you look on the wall, there is a paddle. It's about yay long. It's broken. And it was a paddle that I built for their Pico system.
But for our listeners, a paddle, do you mean like a boat
wooden? It's an oak paddle. It's about 3 foot long. Wider at both ends. One is a handle, the other is a stirring instrument. But when you go to Dragon Mead, it's on the wall on the back bar. Broken Paddle IPA is a paddle that I built for Earl, who bought the system from me for his first brewing system prior to Dragon Mead. So I built him a kegel system that would make anywhere from, 5 to 20 gallons of beer at a time. It's still up on top,
I can actually see it on some of these photos right here.
Exactly.
So if you look at it's kind of like where a mirror is with a bunch of a logo or something above it. So it's right above the main tap. So they have their main tap, and then they have like where their nitro tap is, I think, and their soda taps over on the other side. So definitely over at you can see it the next time you go there.
Sure. So the Broken Paddle IPA is a paddle that I brewed and they broke. But again, I've helped a lot of different breweries. Back when the Tuba Museum was going in East Lansing.
Did you say Tuba Museum?
What was the name of the brewery?
Michigan Brewing Company, wasn't it, or something like that? The guy from Lynchpin used to work there because of the...
Phil... His last name was White, and his first name was Will. Will White owned the Tubing Museum, and it was a restaurant that did food from different parts of the world, and he brewed small batches of beer on a Pico system. And the Pico system was brought out of the basement, put into the beer garden. They brewed, you know, 10-gallon batches. They put it on tap. You know, he actually brewed beer on a kegel system. There was a company in Colorado that did the same thing. So I've been able to help a lot of people go from the Will White never went beyond the Tupu Museum and can't remember the name of the damn brewery.
It's Lynchpin.
I don't
the
think
laundry. It's Lynchpin. Well, guys from last week, he used to
work there, but now it's not the Lynchpin itself.
No,
the Lynchpin is his baby.
Yeah,
he went from there to the Lynchpin to start.
But it wasn't for the Brewgiver, he would not exist.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, Logan, the brewer in India that works for Arbor Brewing Company, he came to the grain elevator that I had hoped to have a brewery in.
It's the Frog Island in Ypsilanti.
Yeah, the Frog Island Brewing Company was going to be at the grain elevator. And I taught Logan how to brew. Duncan, the brewer at Grizzly Peak. Okay.
You still teach people how to brew? Is that
I've taught
constantly
thousands of brewers how to brew. And a couple of them actually done really well.
Do you have a favorite brewer that you taught? A favorite disciple?
Prized,
you're not supposed to have a favorite within your kids.
No, actually, there's no way that none of my kids are going to be better. Well, Duncan came by the shop. He knew how to brew, but he wanted to be part of the Frog Island Brewing Company. And we never made it well enough, but we brewed together several times. We brewed at the 2000 American Homebrewers Conference. We did the brew out in the parking lot at that conference, and Duncan has gone off to be the head brewer at Grizzly Peak. I know Amy from the Ann Arbor Brewers Guild. Amy is one of the scientists at Dogfish Head, and Kim the brewer at
River's Edge.
There's a double connection there because she was part of the Eastern Michigan University's microbiology class, which I would do a batch of beer and show them, you know, what's involved with making beer. And she went on to be a brewer. She traveled all over the country. She's been down to New Orleans, brewing beer down there. And then she came back to Michigan. And the cool thing is that the tanks, the fermenters and the bright tanks that are at River's Edge were the same tanks that I built for the brewery in Westland. Fire Academy in Westland. They went to Saugatuck, and then from Saugatuck, she ended up with those same tanks at River's Edge. So she's got fermenters and bright tanks that I built as Pico Brewing Systems. She was involved with some of the brewing demonstrations at Eastern Michigan University.
So were those the same tanks that Barry started Saugatuck Brewing on then too? So,
yeah, Barry bought his tanks from me.
Maybe you've heard of Saugatuck. There's another brewery he started.
Oh yeah.
So Ken, we're having this 0.5. We have a certain question that we want to ask.
We
kick around, right?
Go for it.
About how big you can be without being out of things. I was out of the room. You said we were going to.
He's bigger than I am, and he's not out of things.
So,
you know,
so we're all good. Once again, we're talking about Michelob Ambiguous.
In regards to what you're saying, the answer is no. That's changed. But we were talking about crosstalk a little bit more. But Rob, go on.
I mean, I guess I had one question because there's always those people who, there's like me who's reading, I guess, the fourth edition of Parzapan's, the guide to home brewing. And I've yet to brew any beers yet. So I guess the question to you guys is that,
Haven't brewed any beer yet?
No, I haven't brewed any beer yet.
You should come by and brew on Brewgiver's homebrew system in my beer garden.
I would love to.
When do you want to brew? I suggest a day that's not shitty.
Sunny.
Sunny day is good because it's outdoors.
And we brew over a fire pit.
We brew over a fire pit.
Mashing a wood barrel.
Wow. I guess for one question, for people who are looking into home brewing, what, I guess, if any style, would you suggest as being the first style that they should brew?
Something they like.
Easy yeah, enough.
Brew what you like, but if you want a beer that's going to have a higher chance of turning out, if that's what you mean.
I mean, I guess some
stouts and IPAs are the easiest beers to make.
I guess something so that, them, yeah, so. Something that, yeah. you know.
Something dark is easy.
If they brew it the first time, it's something that is easy enough that it doesn't discourage people from right. brewing again.
Here it stouts is. And IPAs. Here it is. Here, no, no, no. The very first beer that you brew in your house, as long as it doesn't include half sugar, it won't taste like apple cider, like mine. Pick it. Pick a beer style. Go to a store that sells brewing kits. Buy one. Make it. It's going to be good. Unless you totally mess up with the sanitation, it's going to be good because you don't have the microculture to infect beer in your house to begin with. Now your second beer. You have to pay attention to sanitation, okay? Things have to be clean. You have to make sure that the things are sanitized, things are clean, because you've already made a beer there. All of those microcultures that will grow on beer wort are going to be growing in your environment. You have to be much more careful on your second beer, okay? Sanitation, sanitation, sanitation.
What was that?
That word? Is the... Sanitation is the key.
No, I know what it is. I just wanted you to say it again.
Sanitation is the key to making consistently good beer.
So just like, don't run a hose over it, you know, actually clean it out.
Well, I mean, but you can. It all depends on how much repeatability you
and,
want.
And that's one of the things.
If you we have the Sati that we've been drinking here. Which, you know, I saw it your reaction to face. It when it first hit you in the face. I thought your eyes rolled back in your head. You know,
that beer is wild. It is brewed, not boiled.
Fermented, for
that
sure.
It was fermented. That is unboiled, unpitched beer. That is a naturally fermented, wild second run.
It rode in the back of my truck from the mash tun to my from Brighton to Ypsilanti.
It tasted that way.
Well, not yes. Bad, not but then way, again. But
I could taste Ypsilanti in that beer.
My point exactly. Ypsilanti. Lambic is a culture in the White Labs culture library.
It is. Ypsilanti Lambic is a literal culture you can buy from White Labs.
It is a culture. Oh. I don't know that you can buy it, but it's there.
If you ask them, I'm sure they'll make it for you.
I'm going to check with
what
Chris.
What bubble do I write in to tell them I'm a Ypsilanti Lambic?
You know what? I tell you what. I'm going to talk to Chris this week because the White Labs,
he means Chris White, the owner of White Labs.
Yeah. The White Labs website has expanded to include things that are in their library, but it doesn't list all of the things in the library. And I know that Ypsilanti Lambic is there because my friend Dan McConnell sold his yeast culture kit company, Yeast Library, to...
This was in the late 80s, early 90s, and helped kickstart White Labs as a yeast supplier.
No,
is that too strong of a word, kickstart?
Yeah. Okay. No, I think White Labs was there. But
I have a hard time remembering back to 1991 sometimes. So
I understand that, yes.
So but, what do you guys enjoy most about brewing? Is there something that like,
it's
calls
making
you to brew
something?
The interesting difference that every batch has. I love about microbreweries as opposed to, you know, the Budweiser types is the fact that every batch is a tiny bit different.
This is a little bit different. This is crazy.
You
crazy
can go to your local
right
brewery and drink the same beer, but it's always a tiny bit different. And it's where the real enjoyment's at in beer.
I mean, it's kind of...
I can smell that one for days. I almost sneeze.
Holy Band-Aid. Storm.
Yeah, is this called rye with a side of rye on top of rye with a Band-Aid?
No, that's what Boulevard makes.
This is a Scotch ale. Brewed on my historic system with a skirt on the brew kettle and all the walnut smoke Blew over top of the kettle.
There's
when
so
you
much
say scotch ale, do you mean you just poured scotch into somebody's ale?
There is so much. There is so much.
Walnut wood.
There is so much tasty smoke in that.
Half a pound.
Oh my God, Jesus. That is beautiful. What is wrong with you?
Exactly.
This is beautiful.
I taste.
Cheers.
This is so different than everything else we've tasted.
Right. I taste a bonfire in my mouth.
Yes, it is. It is indeed.
I mean, I guess, you know, in a way, for some people, if they wanted to know what Kingsford briquettes tasted like in their mouth.
No, this is walnut smoke.
This is walnut smoke.
I feel like I'm missing something.
Okay. Yes, you are.
Here, give this to Ken.
I need another red solo.
Just give this to Ken.
There you go.
I feel like if you press two pallets together and lit them on fire, this is what you're drinking.
You need a little more of that.
You taste,
of course you do.
You taste like the hoodie smells when you come home from a bonfire.
You're going into something so tremendously different than everything else we've drank tonight.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I don't think I've ever tasted something as woody, and I think that's that. I would call it Buzz Lightyear because it's that close to woody.
Buzz Lightyear.
I guess this is probably like my one thing because like whenever I bake anything and anything calls for pecans, I use walnuts, and so just like my. Like favoritism towards walnuts and
I mean,
walnuts.
I eat walnuts right before bed because they're a good thing to keep it in your digestive system to lose some weight. But this tastes like a bonfire to me. I mean,
it is a bonfire.
But you know what?
You're right. It does.
Oh
taste
my
like
God,
a
that smell!
I am loving it. I'm loving it.
Yes,
are you kidding?
No,
I got.
This is a Romeo Country bonfire.
The taste is delicious. The smell is something to
the entire talk about engineering.
We're in a whole different realm. I've brewed this. This is my homebrew.
This is your homebrew.
On the same.
Talk into the mic. Thank you.
The smoke beer that we're tasting right now is a Scotch ale that I brewed. Over a wood fire.
It's actually really good.
It is.
It is not supposed to be this smoky, all right? But I put 1/2 pound of cherry smoked malt in this beer. But I made this beer over in my copper kettle over a wood fire, and I added a skirt to the wood to the kettle so that the heat would
the bellow would come up.
Would come up around the side and it would boil better. This was when it was 40 degrees outside, and I've never done this before.
The best beer is made over a campfire.
That's all it tastes. Beer. You can't call this campfire something.
Well, again, this
we
was
could
a
add
Scotch
some marshmallows. In
Camp Brighton.
Yeah, there
Camp
you go.
Camp Brighton.
I didn't make
serve
this
it with
make,
a
make this make this, make this at River's Edge add marshmallows and call it Camp Dearborn beer.
No, you got to burn the marshmallow first, though.
No.
Burn the marshmallow, put over
marshmallows.
Burn a marshmallow,
You know what? That smoke coming around the
Gotta talk into the microphone.
That smoke coming around the edge of the kettle with the skirt to be the perfect place to smoke marshmallows.
Smoke marshmallow.
I want to know the diameter between the points and points on the burner that you have in your lobby there.
We can make this work.
Yeah.
We can make this
and
work.
What I'm going to do is make it maybe a half inch bigger than that.
See, Mike keeps me creative. So I can like become overly obsessed with parodying traditional styles and I spend more time looking at historic brew logs than I do like looking at what the new beer style is. So I can tell you much more about 1860s stout than I can tell you about West Coast IPAs.
Well, what did they drink in the Civil War?
Spruce beer. That is one of my favorites. You hit a note
right there, my friend.
George Washington served spruce beer to all of his troops.
That was the Revolutionary War, not the Civil War.
It was
about 100 years earlier.
You know, by the 1860s, you had a strong German tradition already here.
Buvice beer.
Yeah, but they couldn't lager anything on the battlefield.
No, they weren't drinking on the battlefields, but back at home, you were typically drinking. They actually drank a very popular beer at the time. It was called Münchener beer, which we would think is like München, like, okay, it's going to be a Munich beer, but it was really a bastardization of a Munich beer, which we called Münchener beer that was very popular.
Yeah.
But Pre-prohibition lagers were quite popular at the time still, and porter and stouts were actually, especially porter, more so than stouts, were popular in the country at the time.
So during the crosstalk, we had a lot of conversations.
I'm nothing
we're going to bring up specifically, but I do want to talk about something, because you guys have been within the industry at one point or another for decades. You've seen this grow from 40, 50, 60 to now, like, the last count that I had, including brewers to be opened, is 333.
Wow.
And that doesn't include production facilities that are off-site. Yeah. So, like, Founders, who has Founders Production, which is off-site, that's another one.
Liberty Street, et cetera, et cetera.
Liberty Street, New Holland, Rochester Mills.
Axel.
Yeah. Axel's a production technically only until they open up Livernois Tap Room.
Rochester Mills.
Rochester Mills, yes. They have the well, so, that's a tap room.
But that's
over there
their
too,
only
still.
That's their only place though.
No, Rochester Mills has two places.
They Mountain Tom's got two.
Mountain Tom's got two. So with that in mind, do you guys see, like, it? You know, we were talking about the hop shortage. We were talking about hops growing here, maltsters. Is there a bubble, a company? Like, you can only drink so much beer, and you can only tap in so much to the macro industry.
Is there a bubble? Yes. Is it a dangerous bubble? No. I don't think
what
so.
What do you mean by dangerous bubble?
A bubble that will pop.
Well,
how many bubble?
How many restaurants are there? And how many breweries are there?
Hundreds of thousands. Well, hundreds of thousands.
You know,
to thousands.
If you look at the number of breweries that were in this country at prior to Prohibition, it was about 2,400, something like that. And if you adjust that to population, we need around 8,000 to 9,000 breweries in this country to meet pre-prohibition brewery population ratios. We are not yet there. There was also no Budweiser mega breweries at the time producing those quantities, so we probably won't sustain that same ratio. But I mean, where we are right now, I think is a pretty sustainable level. If we continue to expand, it's going to become harder. Now, Howell, for example, west of me, tiny little town, not a lot of people out there.
Yep.
Right. There's a third brewery coming to that town. That's a lot of competition in a small market. You might want to get some paper towel for that.
I was just going
to wonder if
face.
They have a maid here at Better on
nope,
Draft.
Nope.
So that's, they might need one, apparently.
Rob Everett, go on.
Hey, let's keep
so,
that.
No, I don't think at current levels we're in danger. If we continue to expand at this rate for another 2 or 3 years, yeah, you're going to start seeing people flame out.
So I'm going to ask you a question, and I can cut this out if we don't like it. Does the term craft beer mean anything to you?
It does. It does. I mean,
what does it mean?
I mean, it means that the ownership is involved in the production, that the ownership cares about their product at something beyond the income of their business. It means that it has some kind of local involvement in the community.
So I'm gonna take a step back. We can keep going after this. But what about Atwater, whose owners are not the brewers? The brewers are completely separate of the owners. Mm-hmm. Same with Black Lotus. You have Black Lotus right around the corner in Clawson. Nick, the brewer, is the brewer, and the owners are the owners. So do you consider them craft in a sense? Or
they are, because they're very much at the craft level. You know, if they were 20 times bigger, and there was absolutely no involvement in the product of the ownership, I might have more issue with it. But you know, when you're, it's perfectly okay for a guy who's making 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 barrels a year to not be doing the brewing. He's still very much involved in his business.
So then let's bring it back to Augustus Busch III. You know, that's you're talking family lineage. You're talking someone who understands the industry, understands the brewing process. Why would it?
I don't know what he has. I mean, at that point in time, clearly, you know, when you have thousands of people working for you in a marketing department, you know, Budweiser spends what, 4 or 5 times on marketing what they do on brewing.
Right.
If you actually look them up in, I think it was, is it Dun & Bradstreet? They're listed under marketing companies, not as brewers.
It sprints
because
so
the majority of their revenue is spent on marketing,
yeah,
not on product production. So when your budget for marketing exceeds your budget for production of beer, you're no longer a craft brewer.
Okay, that's a fair statement. I would highly suggest, and I don't know if you read it all or if it's something. I'm an audiobook person because I do a lot of driving. Bitter Brew, a really, really, really good book in regards to the.
I'm aware of it. I have not read it.
In regards to the rise. The Prohibition, which isn't necessarily the fall, because Budweiser stayed in business by making root beer, soap, and a few other products.
They did what they could, right.
And then the re-rise of Budweiser. But nonetheless, like, that book is a really solid book in regards to the story and explains Augustus Bush III's life within the industry. Now, he's not like your atypical... let's say the Downey family over in Downey or over in Dearborn, Michigan. You know, the Downey family, that's literally a family production. The father's the brewer, the kids are the marketing / the research team, the mother is the cheerleader. You know, we had them on our show, they knew exactly what was going on.
But they used Yo Brian Crest. But they use Yo Brian Crest for their.
Mike likes them particularly because his family crest and their family crest are the same.
The Downey crest are the same.
Okay.
I did a little research.
Pride point.
And apparently, Downies are all from Northern Ireland, and so Downey family
You mean orange?
Yeah. and the Downey family are known as defenders. So my guess is that the certain aspect of the Downey clan moved to County Clare, which happens to be where the O'Brien clan is, and they were able to the Downey clan was so accepted by the O'Brien clan that they allowed the Downey clan to use the O'Brien crest.
You sure it's not the other way around?
No. I know that for a fact.
Are you positive?
The Downey clan, their crest is three wild boars. If you look at the Downey family lineage in Ireland, what the hell? But anyway, their crest is three wild boars, and the Downeys that moved to Southern Ireland, moved to County Clare, they were defenders. So I'm guessing that they helped the O'Brien clan defend the O'Brien castle and so on and so forth, to the point where...
You had a castle?
Hell yes. We got lots of castles.
Can you give me a tour? I've never been to Ireland.
Well, there you go. I'd love to. But the Downey clan was accepted by the O'Brien clan... and allowed to use the same family crest. And so, back then they appreciated them. I currently appreciate them. I think they make great beers over there.
So you've been to Downey Brewing?
Of course I have. They have the O'Brien crest on the wall.
great brewery over there. We're actually going to have them back on our show in 2 months, I believe.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting because we had them on before they opened. So it'll be interesting to see their story post opening for sure.
Sure.
I still do have my I have a coupon for them for a pint.
Is it coupon or coupon?
Coupon. at a later date. What
are
did
you
just
from Michigan
pour
or not?
Us?
That's the question. That is more Oak Creek Double.
More Oak Creek
Double. Oak Creek Double, the barrel-aged Belgian Double with cherries.
Why didn't you pour me more? Do we have more? Because I'm just going to take it all.
I have half a bottle here.
That's what
she
said.
It's bottle conditioned. Pour gently. Oh, God, Mike, thanks.
There's no...
He's fine.
Yeah, I hope you like
chewing. We're good. He's still pouring. I don't think he understands.
Yes. I don't want to pour the tube. Yes. I'm going to drink that myself.
I thought I was going to get some more of that beer. I would have put more in my glass if I know you're going to do
that. That's how you pour.
I tried to stop him, but...
No. Yeah, but I saw that look of challenge in your eyes.
That's how you pour.
Where you looked at him and said, "I will not respect you if you stop."
As we're kind of like getting this to a close, I do appreciate you guys staying over. I do love this little half podcast. Yeah. Where do you guys see yourselves in 5 years in regards to let's start with Brewery Becker. Like, where do you see yourself and the industry for that matter in 5 years?
Industry wise, it's going to continue to mature. We're going to add probably 50 to 100 more successful breweries that will stick around in Michigan. You'll have a brewery in every single town in the state, if not two. And most of them are going to stick around.
I don't know if Leroy, Michigan needs a brewery.
Roseville won't.
If people manage their money properly, yes, there's no reason we can't stay at 350 or 400 breweries.
You say Roseville doesn't have one, but I guarantee you, if you put one in Roseville, it'll succeed.
Dragon's almost
it
Roseville.
Will. Yes, it will.
Yeah, put it right next to the Palladium.
If you make a Sellerman style brewery where you have that mainstay of that light lager, that Kolsch like they have over in Brighton.
Yeah, let's throw that there. Brighton isn't a very hoity-toity neighborhood.
Oh, it's blue collar.
Brighton's very blue collar.
We have an odd – in Brighton, we like to say we're 50% doctors, 50% EIEIO.
So how do you think a small
town – It's an interesting town.
But like – and you said, you know, most people come in, they want your yellow beer, your Kolsch, your in the middle beer.
Yep.
But how do you suspect super blue towns like a Roseville, like – I mean, you've mentioned
people still want better beer. I mean, once somebody realizes that beer does not, I can't tell you how many times I've had a woman come into my brewery who says, beer is the shittiest thing ever invented by man. I despise it. And that's because she's drank nothing but Bud Light and that Ultra that you forcibly subjected us to earlier.
And plus she didn't really know the history because beer was
invented by women. And then I give her a Hefeweizen, or I give her a Radler, I give her a Shandy or a Kolsch, and then she all of a sudden, or you know, and if those don't work, then I start to head for the fruit beers, like a raspberry lambic or something like that.
Right. I would think
beer haven't tasted the beer that they like.
Right.
There are so many different beers.
Or they're celiacs.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's celiacs too.
So we degluminize all our beers. If you're celiacs, you can go to my brewery and drink all 14 beers on tap right now.
Really?
I degluminize every beer.
What is degluminizing?
It's simple and easy, and I don't know why every brewery in the world doesn't do it.
Yep.
You know what it cost me to degluminize a batch of beer?
I still don't know what degluminize is.
$5.
$5.
Hopefully not per pint.
They're breaking down the gluten beer within
an entire batch. Yes. So I have no idea why every brewery doesn't do this.
To the boil kettle, I'm thinking.
Yeah, it goes into the fermenter. So gluten is a complex of proteins, and it only forms in cool temperatures in solution. Yep. And so, for example, when the beer comes right out of your kettle, it's going to start forming gluten. One of those enzymes is called proline. So we add what's called a proline specific endoprotease, so a enzyme that will break down proline outside of the cell, and it breaks down the proline. And without proline, you're missing one of the puzzle pieces of gluten, so gluten doesn't form.
Oh,
so I started doing this probably 12, 13 years ago now, sure, because a good buddy of mine, big strong man who I drank a lot of beer with, developed celiac disease, and we'd go to parties and, instead of being that loud guy who was the life of the party, he was that quiet dude in the corner crying into his wine cooler.
He couldn't drink.
So
he can't.
So I did a little research, and I started using this. And then a couple years after that, Charlie Papasan wrote a piece saying on Clarity Firm saying Papasan. I don't know him personally, like the brew guy over here. I know you have. So, who haven't you met, Mike?
He hasn't met us yet, but now he has.
Yeah.
So therefore he's met everything.
Wow. You haven't met Dan or Nick, which are quite the dynamic duo.
But still, now I feel like I know.
Dan is 6'3".
And
Nick is 4'3".
And Ranker on the show.
Yeah. That was you. That was you.
I would just sit there and be quiet.
Have you ever heard of a classic American Pilsner?
Classic American Pilsner.
A cap,
Pilsner,
as people call it. It's a pre-prohibition Pilsner.
Oh, like Batch 19 from Miller Coors.
The man who reinvented that style lives in Ann Arbor. His name is Jeff Renner. And the best brewer I've ever met in my lifetime, who is also a member of one of the board of directors of the BA and the American Homebrewer Association, Jeff Rankert, also lives out in the West, in Milford.
He lives in Milford.
And these two guys are they're just amazing individuals. You should have them on your show. I don't know if you're open to that.
We'll share contacts.
Push them way. Push them that way.
So, where were they going? I sidetracked myself.
Well, it's not even sidetracked, but that's a great thing that I don't think you guys For the fact that, like, I saw it on your site and I saw the DG logo or the DG acronym, but for the fact that celiacs is such a large group of people, and people are more understanding in regards to what it is. Mm-hmm.
It denies people beer, and that's a crime against man.
Exactly.
You know, there are like groups on Facebook that are looking for.
I've had people cry at my brewery.
Really?
Who have been at celiacs for decades, and they've said, "This is the first time I've drank real beer in 20 years, and it wasn't some sorghum millet thing."
Wow.
And you know, they literally came to tears at the bar. They were so happy that they can finally drink regular beer again. And it's so cheap and so easy to do. I don't understand why everyone doesn't do it.
So right. you've had people with celiacs come in, drink your beer
all the time.
Sign.
All the time. Constantly.
That's such a crazy idea and
concept. I'm talking barley and wheat beers. Hefeweizens. Beers that are 50% wheat malt they're drinking.
Well, I got a buddy in St. Clair Shores that needs to definitely make a drive out.
Do you guys do growlers to go?
We do, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
That's a great thing to do, especially for that. Do you guys do crawlers or
we have growlers and
howlers
right yeah whatever
crawlers are the cans
crawlers are cans and now what do they have prowlers
which are 16 ounces
which I'm having a considering that this bottle of beer I brought here is 22 ounces I'm having a hard time understanding the point of a prowler, but
so the prowler from I learned about a prowler. Maybe if it's at like drafting
a
20, table,
like my I have a 20%er. I can see a prowler of that beer, but maybe not too many.
So drafting table does it for their employees who might not want their shift drink at the end of the night and want to like go home and have it for another day or something like
table,
that.
That's
Kristen and
Del Brewer from Witch's Hat, right?
Yep. Just simply Mean Vanilla Bean by far. I don't know anybody who uses enough vanilla as much as they do. That is a damn good
beer. He needs to meet Matt in the Hat.
Damn good beer.
I was going to say, Matt owns the vanilla.
Yeah, but he's also the guy who imports his vanilla from Madagascar, yes, too. He's
nice. It's been basically like the ones that I've ran into, like with Avery and their vanilla bean stout. It's like basically I have to have that sit 6 months just to even get the vanilla flavor that Drafting Table has in their mean vanilla bean. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to make sure if you want to get strong vanilla flavor, you got to add enough of it.
Yeah.
You can't, it's like fruit. You know, people say 3 pounds a gallon of fruit. That's insanity. Not if you want a strong fruit flavor.
Right.
Ask Ken Schramm. You guys know Schramm Meadery?
Oh, yeah. We know of them. We haven't had them on the show or anything.
He
well, mead's
literally
not beer, so.
Yeah.
I know it's mead, but I'm gonna pause here. He is the best mead maker in the world.
I mean, we've had a distillery on the show, so I mean, there's really nothing wrong with the best distiller
in the world.
Kent Schramm is
the best mead maker in the world.
Yes.
In the world.
He was also
and not only is he the best person in the world, he's a league above every other mead maker in the world.
So somehow
nobody else in the mead world it showed even up worth as my, talking to.
It showed up as my Facebook.
Get
and it
him
says,
in here.
One
He's
ounce
local.
Pours of the Heart of Darkness Batch 5 are available $15 per ounce.
For an ounce.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the bottles are selling tomorrow for $150.
Right.
I know somebody was
somebody put up a
Heart
trade for a Nintendo
the thank
Switch.
You beer. Oh,
Heart
I didn't see the Switch.
Heart of Darkness is Heart of Darkness is fruit harvested from Ken Schramm's backyard. All right, there are
from
cherries
he's been growing there for like 30 years.
There are raspberries and there are black currants that are hand picked. In his backyard.
But these are cultivars that he essentially stole from Belgium and brought back here. And they're like...
Sharp-beak cherries.
Yeah.
You can't buy sharp-beak cherries.
Yeah.
Or as we call them now, Schramm-beak cherries.
Schramm-beak cherries. I'm sorry. anywhere except between Ken's place and maybe something to do with Michigan State Brewing Company. Michigan State University. But... You are dealing with something that is so unique, something that
we really love him, as you can
I mean,
tell.
It's certainly unique for it to be, you know, $150 a bottle.
That is the drawback of his stuff. Unfortunately, it is so good,
and
the price tag has gone up.
He's only making 5 or 10 gallons of the stuff.
I mean, and that
five or ten gallons
for,
of the
For the price?
Mead,
I mean, that makes sense.
Made from his backyard, from the selected fruit.
Cherries that this guy has been hand cultivating for 30 years in his backyard. I mean, you can't imagine the amount. I mean, these things are perfect.
So for everybody who is standing in line right now for the release
it's
tomorrow,
gone. It's gone.
This apparently is absolutely worth it.
Step one,
it is
shove cherries in your bum. Step two, cultivate them for 30 years. Step three, take over the world.
I think, don't you have to put them back out at some point?
I was saying, that sounds like some strange Pulp Fiction shit.
I know we sound like a bunch of fanboys right now, but there is...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but
we can argue about who's the best brewery in the world. Nobody argues about who the best mead maker in the world is. There's only one best mead maker in the world, and it's Ken Schramm.
And he wrote the book.
And the guy literally wrote the book on mead.
Wow.
So
you know when Bee Nectar decided to make mead, and they grabbed a book and figured out how to make mead. You know whose book they read? Ken Schramm's.
Where was the first Heart of Darkness released from?
Belgium.
Belgium. Not Schramm. Bee Nectar.
Oh,
Bee Nectar released Heart of Darkness number one.
Yeah, they've had a long cooperation with them.
They have. They have.
I know, like, the
there's a Ferndale connection that is
the,
not...
The people
they're
who,
both in Ferndale, for gosh sakes.
Well, the people who created Bee Nectar worked at Schramm's at one point, and then...
No. Schramm's didn't even exist before Bee Nectar started.
Really? Schramm only opened a couple years ago.
Bee Nectar started way before Schramm's opened up.
Really?
And the very first Heart of Darkness.
They read
was
his book,
brewed.
Though, and he had something to do with them. Wasn't he helping him out or something?
Yeah, heck yes. I mean, he consults with everybody, and he was
He's a very nice guy who's willing to share his love.
I'm looking at it open September 27, 2013. I swore they were older. But I know the people at Sellerman's are from Bee Nectar. That I know for a fact.
Yes, yeah.
So
that could be.
Dominic and those people, I tell you what, if you haven't checked out Sellerman's, definitely check them out.
Yeah.
Great friends of the show. They have probably one of my favorite meads out there, which is probably halfway because it's affordable, and the other half.
You know, that's a really thing to consider. You know, a guy came in, he's buying like 20 kegs for a big convention, and... He said, you know what I would love? I would love to have Ken Schramm's mead at my convention. But I can't afford $400 a six barrel.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a problem for Ken. I mean,
Cultivate in Ypsilanti often has Ken Schramm's meads on tap at Cultivate in Ypsilanti.
It's not
cheap per glass.
No.
Don't get me wrong.
But if you check out Sellerman's over in Hazel Park, their Moscow Mule, which is something
I've heard a lot of nice things about.
Yeah.
I will talk about and live by forever. And their Krampus. Sure. Their Krampus is definitely one of the best. But the Moscow Mule is definitely a Moscow Mule tasting mead. And it's a ridiculous concept that you're like, this shouldn't be existing at all.
Except it does.
It does. And it tastes perfect. And they sell it in the copper glasses, too. So you don't even
have to. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. That's awesome. I'm glad he takes it seriously.
Oh, yeah. Dominic and the other guys are really, really good. We had Dominic on the show before they opened, I think right before they opened. Matt, this is pre-Bush.
Yeah. PB.
I think this was even pre-Rob.
PB.
Who was it?
Dominic from Sellerman.
You know, when you say pre-Bush to people
that was,
not in the know,
that was definitely
we think different things.
Under 11 years old. Pre-Matt Bush.
Yeah, it's just like, cause to me, pre-Bush is like, you know.
And
pre-Bush is the 90s, man.
So, guys, I appreciate you coming on out. I appreciate you staying a little longer. I mean, we were almost at a three-hour mark for this show.
Yeah, no problem.
Definitely check them out. Brewery Becker. Friends of those who have celiacs.
Next time you're up on 96, just stop in Brighton and get their beer. 500 they West
right.
Main Street.
They got beer to go, so that's beer you can take
home
and drink.
Have, like, fancy flip-top growlers, too. So take it. Have something. It's those Grohl-style ones, so have it put on top of your fridge. Right. Act like you're cool and fancy in front of your friends.
That's going to do it for us here at Better on Draft, episode 78 and a half. Once again, the Brew Guyver, owner of Brewery Becker, thank you for joining us. We appreciate you coming. No matter what you think of your beer, we think it's Better on Draft. Have a good night, folks. Drive safe.
Peace out.